Understanding the other side. To choose the best influence approach, you must consider the world from the other person's point of view. Each of us travels through life in our own little box. That is to say, our view of the world is limited, or walled in, by our values, beliefs, experiences, and goals. As we peer out at the world through the walls of our box, everything we see is shaped by our own point of view. But to influence others, you have to mentally visit their box and see how the world looks to them. If you can develop the ability to adopt another person's viewpoint, you will have taken one huge giant step toward becoming a political winner. Let's consider the earlier example of Darren, who wants his boss to send him to Germany. From Darren's point of view, this trip would be an exciting journey, an opportunity to add international experience to his resume, and possibly the next step toward a promotion. Speaking strictly from his own box, Darren might say to his boss, "I understand that you need to send someone to Germany to work on the Anderson Project. I just want you to know that I would love to get that assignment. I've never been to Europe, so it would be awfully exciting for me, and I could really use the international experience. This would be a big step forward in my career." But to understand his boss's view, Darren probably needs to consider these questions. What are his manager's goals for this project? What qualifications does she feel are important for this assignment? What is her opinion of his previous work? Might she have any reservations about sending him to Germany? Is there anyone whom she might consider more qualified? Who would handle his current responsibilities while he's gone? How would her boss view Darren's participation? Pondering these issues might inspire Darren to change his approach. "I understand that you need to send someone to Germany to work on the Anderson Project. I've been reviewing the project documents, and I think that my experience on our last two projects could really help to make this one work. We overcame some of the same obstacles that they seem to be facing, and I've already worked with several members of this project team. I know that you may have been considering Kevin for this assignment because of his international experience, but I have some ideas about how we might split the project duties to use both our talents. I could bring Wanda up to speed on my current projects so that she could fill in while I'm gone. What do you think?" Exactly why is this strategy more likely to succeed? First, Darren has framed his request in terms of shared goals. Instead of being all about Darren, "It would be awfully exciting for me. I could really use the international experience," he stresses the success of the project, a much more pertinent goal for his boss. Second, Darren has made the effort to anticipate objections and concerns. He has recognized that completion of his current work could be an issue and identified Kevin as his strongest competition for the assignment. Third, he has tried to assess the leverage equation. Because his boss appears to have all the power in this situation, Darren hopes to boost his own leverage a bit by mentioning his previous experience with similar projects and his relationship with the project team members. Finally, he ends by soliciting her point of view. The best way to get inside someone else's box is to ask questions and really listen to the answers. Although there is no ironclad guarantee that Darren's manager will agree, this strategy should definitely improve his chances of getting the assignment. Suppose you find yourself in a situation where you feel absolutely certain that another person's idea, plan, or behavior is absolutely wrong. What then? This is when it is most difficult to see the other side, and when it's also most important to make the effort. In most conflicts, People are not disagreeing about the facts. They're wrong usually translates as they don't agree with my opinion. Keep this in mind. Facts can be wrong. Opinions are simply different. Apart from legal and ethical issues, the conclusion that someone is wrong is probably both inaccurate and politically detrimental. A county mental health agency acquired a new director who had a medical background. One of her first actions was to replace the agency's training program with a new curriculum based on a medical model. To the mental health managers, all of whom had been with the agency for at least 10 years, this change was clearly wrong. They conveyed their negative opinions to the new director at every opportunity, complaining about the content of the training, the length of the program, and the fact that medical approaches had no relevance for mental health professionals. In response to their objections, the director immediately scrapped the new training program, right? Of course not. The manager's constant criticism did indeed convince the director that there was a big problem, but with the management team, not the training. If these managers really wanted to influence their new boss, they needed to consider her view of the situation and open their minds to some new approaches. Hammering people with your own opinions seldom changes anything. When you really try to understand other people's points of view, they will frequently reciprocate by listening to yours. Keeping your eyes on the prize. The ability to maintain a laser-like focus on your true goal is another critical influence skill. In complex and emotionally charged interactions, people often lose sight of their objectives and lapse into counterproductive behavior. Before becoming hopelessly entangled in these confusing scenarios, you must clearly define exactly what is most significant to you and keep your eyes on that prize. Whenever you become angry or frustrated, just continue to ask yourself, what specifically is most important to me in this situation? What do I want? And then manage your behavior accordingly. I recently found myself in one of these tricky circumstances. A very intelligent but totally disorganized university professor asked me to help create a leadership development program for a large corporate client. My areas of program responsibility involved leadership assessment and team building, with additional consultants handling a variety of other topics. As project leader, the professor was responsible for defining objectives, creating a program outline, managing the budget, and developing a schedule. Unfortunately, we all soon discovered that her organizational skills were non-existent, but she saw no problem whatsoever. So, what's the solution? Make her see the difficulties that she is creating? Try to take over the administrative tasks? The best course of action depends on my goal. And in this situation, my primary goal is simply to make a good impression on the client with my part of the program. I have no control over the rest of the curriculum or the management of the project. If I offended the professor, I might be taken off the project altogether. So I needed to, 1, let go of my opinions about how a leadership development program should operate, 2, put up with the frustrations, 3, be a pleasant and cooperative colleague, and 4, do the best work I can within my areas of responsibility. When people feel they are being criticized, they often employ diversionary tactics to distract you from your goal. Such distractions can take many forms, including anger, tears, excuses, or shifting the focus elsewhere. In the recreational baseball league that he manages, my husband John recently had to deal with a player who had threatened an umpire with physical harm. As soon as John brought up the matter, the player replied angrily, "That guy can't tell a ball from a strike. He gets calls wrong all the time. He shouldn't be an umpire at all. You need to fire him. That's not the issue here, said John. The issue is that we can't have people making physical threats under any circumstances. But he cursed at me, the player shot back. He shouldn't be swearing and taking the Lord's name in vain. I don't have to put up with that. If that's the case, I'll talk with him about it, John said. But the issue here is your own behavior. You cannot make threats to anyone. If you do, you can't play in this league. After a few more diversionary attempts, the player grudgingly agreed. Sometimes, especially when emotions are running high, people get so carried away that they fail to recognize when their goal has actually been reached. While working on an important project, Marissa began to feel that the project manager was intentionally leaving her out of major decisions. Although she tried to discuss this with him on several occasions, he paid little attention to her concerns. By the time she finally complained to her boss, Carlos, Marissa had progressed from annoyance to full-blown fury. After agreeing to mediate the situation, Carlos met with a project manager to hear his version of events, then brought the two of them together to discuss the issue. Carlos tells me you're having a problem, said the project manager. I'm having a problem with you, exclaimed Marissa angrily. You completely ignore my suggestions and never invite me to meetings where the decisions are made. This project is getting really screwed up, and you don't seem to realize it. So, what is it you want me to do exactly? Responded the project manager. I want to be involved in meetings about how the project will be implemented. My department will be the one using this new system, so we need to have input on how it operates, replied Marissa. That seems reasonable enough, the project manager said. I have no problem including you in those meetings. But you have totally ignored all my suggestions about this project, Marissa repeated. Whenever I've tried to talk to you about it, you give absolutely no consideration to my point of view. I think that you're just... Marissa. Carlos interrupted quietly. I believe you got what you wanted, didn't you? Oh, said Marissa, taking a deep breath. I guess I did. If you are not clear about your objectives, both long-term and short-term, then you will be driven by your immediate needs, wants, desires, and feelings. You may ultimately find that the greatest obstacle to achieving your goals is staring back at you in the mirror. To make a wise decision about your influence strategy, you have to know what you want. Balancing your influence toolbox. A project team at an advertising agency is developing a new ad campaign for a client. Two members of the group, Paul and Donna, feel that the team needs to take a different approach to the project. At the next meeting, Paul brings up the subject. I think we're making some mistakes here, he says. Before we go any further, we really need to consider the objectives of this campaign. I'd like to describe a different strategy that I think may be more appealing to this particular client. After Paul finishes his presentation, Donna speaks up. I sense some concern about Paul's comments and would like to hear what the rest of you think. Let's go around the table and get everyone's opinion. After listening carefully to all the responses, Donna summarizes what she heard. It sounds as though people see some merit in Paul's ideas, but are worried about whether we can meet the project's schedule if we change direction now. Is that correct? Donna and Paul exemplify two opposite influence strategies. Paul is using direct influence. He tells people exactly what he thinks and attempts to convince them that he is right. Donna, on the other hand, is using indirect influence. She watches people's reactions, asks questions, and learns from their responses. In your influence toolbox, direct and indirect skills are like a hammer and screwdriver. Both are useful, but you need to use the right tool at the right time. If you only possess one of these implements, certain situations may be challenging. Driving a nail with a screwdriver can be tough. Because most of us have a natural inclination to be either more direct or indirect, acting unconsciously, automatically produces a heavier reliance on one set of skills and a failure to recognize situations that call for the other. Mistakes can be made in either direction. Ralph, the new director of a large department, attended many meetings during his first 2 months on the job. In all of them, he listened quietly, occasionally asked a question, never stated an opinion. Most of the time, he sat away from the table or in the back of the room. People soon began to question his leadership ability. Vicky, on the other hand, was in a job where she had no direct authority over anyone, yet had to ensure that projects were completed on schedule. She dictated timelines to project participants, sent frequent emails telling them what to do, and argued about how their tasks should be prioritized. After a while, they just ignored her. Both Ralph and Vicky were simply overusing their natural style. To optimize your influencing ability, you need to possess a full set of tools. That way, you will have a greater variety of choices available in any situation. A range of influence strategies is on a continuum from indirect skills to direct skills. First, decide which are most comfortable for you and which are most difficult. Then determine when you might benefit from using the ones that you avoid or neglect. Once you start experimenting with these less familiar skills, be patient with yourself and don't give up. Developing any new ability takes time and practice. I doubt that you were able to drive a car the first time you got behind the wheel. Observe and wait. Ask and listen. Persuade and convince. Order and act. Observe and wait. The power of watchful waiting is often overlooked. My own role model for this particular skill was a colleague named Carl, who had mastered the art of the perfect moment. Several hours into a day-long committee meeting, led by a woman who had completely lost control of the group, most of the participants, myself included, were heatedly debating, arguing, and disagreeing. Carl, however, had hardly said a word. Finally, just when we were about ready to start throwing coffee mugs at each other, Carl spoke up. "What do you think about this idea?" he asked, then proceeded to outline a plan that seamlessly combined our various points of view. By watching and waiting, Carl had been able to spot the perfect moment to introduce his suggestions. Because he had previously been so quiet, as soon as he spoke, everyone else fell silent and listened with rapt attention. Sometimes, as they say, less is more. To be a political winner, you must learn to quickly process a constant stream of observations. Watching the daily ebb and flow of the political tides will help you detect conflicts, alliances, and leverage shifts. During individual encounters, nonverbal signals can alert you to the feelings and reactions of the other party. In a meeting, monitoring the topic changes and interpersonal undercurrents may reveal the perfect moment to make your point. Accurate and timely observations are essential to the influence process, since they enable you to select the most effective strategy for each situation. Waiting, the decision to postpone action, can feel like torture to those who are naturally inclined to do something, anything, that feels like forward motion. But sometimes doing nothing is the wisest course. Art, a successful salesman, had unfortunately acquired a boss who was a complete dimwit. For several months, Art put his best sales skills to work on this manager, attempting to change her leadership style and improve their communication. He was in her office almost every day, working on their relationship. Sadly, all this activity only convinced her that Art was a pest. Art's talent for direct influencing had served him well in sales, but watchful waiting would have been a much better strategy in this situation. Any strength carried to an extreme becomes a weakness. Too much waiting and observing will only convince others that you have nothing to say. If you are most comfortable when you can sit quietly and absorb the conversation, then you probably overuse this skill and need to practice being more direct. Does this mean that you should start yapping your head off in every meeting? Heavens no. But you do need to recognize those situations where speaking up could help you achieve your goals. Once you spot such an opportunity, you must force yourself to overcome whatever fear is holding you back. If you're afraid that you might say something stupid, don't worry about it. You're probably screening your words so carefully that nothing remotely foolish could slip past your lips. Ask and listen. The very best consultants, counselors, and salespeople are all masters of asking and listening. They understand that the more you know about another person, the more influential and helpful you can be. Think for a moment about your own conversations. When someone else is speaking, do you actually listen? Or are you mentally rehearsing your reply? Really listening means being fully focused on the other person, not fidgeting, multitasking, or impatiently waiting for your turn to talk. You already know how to do this. Suppose your CEO walks in and says, "I have something very important to tell you." I guarantee that you will listen with rapt attention. No need to waste your time or money attending a listening workshop. Simply turn on your listening skills during any important conversation, not just those with the CEO. Those who neglect their indirect skills often miss opportunities to fully understand others' concerns, problems, values, or opinions. But the true motor mouths never even get to hear what other people might have to say. Their compulsive talking is so extreme that it appears to be a pathological disorder. They almost literally never shut up. If you are in this category, no one is likely to tell you. Well, how could they? But if this sounds at all like you, get some help. You will rarely influence anyone unless you improve your verbal self-management, because the more you talk, the less people hear. The artful use of questions can be a wonderfully effective method for influencing others. To be meaningful, a question must be an actual inquiry, not merely a statement ending with a question mark. "I think this vacation policy is really stupid, don't you?" is not a real question. Nor is, "What idiot came up with the new vacation policy?" But, "What do you think of the new vacation policy?" actually asks for an opinion. In your influence toolbox, questions are like a Swiss Army knife. They can be used in many different situations. Exploratory questions help you understand the other person's point of view and convey that you are interested in their experiences, opinions, or ideas. Example: a product manager wants to learn about customer reactions and decides to talk with a salesperson. Instead of saying, "I'll bet your customers love the new product line, don't they?" he should ask, "What have your customers had to say about the new product line?" Involvement questions aim to increase buy-in by inviting others to participate in a project or help plan a change. Example: a human resources specialist wants to implement a new dress code for employees. Instead of announcing, "We will be sending out a dress code to improve appearance in the office," she should first ask employees, "How would you define professional and unprofessional dress at work?" Then implement some of their suggestions. Softening questions reduce defensiveness and help you bring up a topic or get a point across in a less confrontational manner. Example: A project team member feels that the group is having too many meetings and has decided to bring this up to the team leader. Instead of saying, "You're wasting too much time having all these meetings," she should ask, "What would you think about reducing the number of meetings we're having?" Asking questions is a pointless exercise, of course, unless you plan to listen to the answer. Asking and listening can also be overdone. Too many questions, one right after another, can make the other party feel like a suspect under interrogation. And if you only listen, without ever sharing your own opinions, people may eventually decide that you have something to hide. The most effective communication is always two-way. Persuade and convince. How do con men or women separate people from their money? How do preachers inspire people to live right and do good works? How do recruiters get young folks to join the army and be all that they can be? By being persuasive, convincing, and masters of direct influence. If you give yourself high marks on indirect skills, then you may need to get more comfortable with the direct approach. To help you become more directly persuasive, here are 10 tips to consider. 1. Do your homework. You will adopt the persuader role more comfortably if you are fully informed about your subject and able to answer questions intelligently. 2. Speak up. Psychic persuasion is seldom successful. Talking is usually required. 3. Demonstrate confidence. Should the car salesman start his pitch by saying, "I don't know if you're really going to like this model very much," or, "This is really a great car"? You get the idea? Remember that confidence is conveyed not only by your words, but also by your tone, posture, and expression. 4. Don't try to fake it. If you don't know something, say so. Attempts at bluffing are usually obvious and just make you appear foolish and insecure. Truly confident people readily say, "I don't know," then follow it up with, "But I'll find out." 5. Believe in your product. Regardless of whether your product is an idea, a suggestion, a policy, or a program, you can only convince others of its worth if you are a believer yourself. 6. Know your audience. Exactly who are your objects of influence? Consider their background, experiences, hot buttons, needs, fears, and attention span. Then shape your communication accordingly. 7. Look for shared goals and common interests. Determine how your proposal would benefit the other party. "What's in it for me?" is the first question on anyone's mind. That's just human nature. 8. Generate excitement. Paint a mental picture. Tell a story. Catch their attention. Be upbeat and positive. After graduating from college, my daughter, an advertising major, began her letter to prospective employers with this opening line: "I'm quick, sharp, and smart. Hire me now, while I'm still inexpensive." She got a lot of interviews. 9. Get them involved. If you drone on too long, people will tune you out and start thinking about what they want for lunch. Engaging them in discussion will hold their interest and make you more persuasive. You can't convince someone who has stopped paying attention. 10. Don't forget your indirect skills. The most effective persuaders also know when to shut up and listen. Finally, always be on the lookout for role models. When you spot a master of persuasion, study any useful techniques and adapt them to your own style. Order and act. Sometimes you only get results by being extremely direct. During a recent workshop, the participants and I noticed an odd smell wafting into the room and found a work crew painting the patio outside our windows. I nicely explained that because the fumes were quite strong, we would appreciate their completing the painting after we left for the day. But when they came back half an hour later, with the smell worse than ever, a more direct approach seemed to be in order. "I need for you to stop painting now," I said to the crew leader. "If this is a problem, I will be glad to explain it to your supervisor, but we can't have any more painting while we're in this room." I stood there until they stopped. Being direct does not mean being rude or offensive, but it does mean being firm. Order and act is an appropriate strategy whenever the situation calls for strong leadership. After being appointed to head a state government agency, Joan discovered that important fiscal policies were not being followed and that some managers were engaged in questionable ethical practices. She quickly issued new policy directives, installed tighter financial controls, fired the ethical offenders, and met with every management team in the agency to make her expectations clear. In these circumstances, an indirect approach would have been useless. Direct skills can also be helpful when a group lacks clear direction, has difficulty making decisions, or includes many inexperienced members. On the home front, use direct influence to set clear limits for children. Let your spouse know what's bothering you, or assertively deal with annoying relatives. Relying too heavily on direct skills can provoke resistance and defensiveness because people may feel they are being inappropriately ordered around. If the term control freak has ever been applied to you, then you undoubtedly need to beef up your indirect influencing ability. Ironically, those who most want to take control are often the least influential members in a group, because others fear that they may be too power-hungry. So what does it take to be influential? 1. An awareness of what you're doing and how others are reacting to you. 2. A clear focus on your goals in every situation. 3. The willingness to understand another person's point of view. 4. The ability to make conscious choices about your behavior and not be blindly driven by your emotions. And 5. A full set of influence skills to keep you from overdoing your natural tendencies. Personal politics. How good are you at self-management? Assessing your situation. Using the following rating system, rate yourself on your self-management ability with a score of 4 for almost always, 3 for often, 2 for seldom, and 1 for almost never. I am able to view my actions with the eye of an outside observer. I am good at anticipating how people will react in different situations. I am able to keep myself from saying things that might be unwise. I stop myself from doing things that could have negative consequences. I am consciously aware of my actions and reactions around others. I have tried to develop behaviors that are outside my comfort zone. I make conscious choices about what I say and do with others. From this point forward, rate with a score of 1 for almost always, 2 for often, 3 for seldom, and 4 for almost never. I am often surprised by the way others view my behavior. I tend to act without thinking. I believe in doing what comes naturally so that I can really be myself. I often regret the actions that I have taken. I say things to others without considering how they may react. I tend to do things that are against my better judgment. I find it hard to stop myself from doing things that I really want to do. Count the number of 4s, 3s, 2s, and 1s that you gave yourself and put those numbers in a table with 4s and 3s grouped under higher self-management skill and 2s and 1s in lower self-management skills. The more scores you have on the higher self-management side, the better your skills. This assumes, of course, that you are able to evaluate yourself accurately, which is not always the case. The more scores on the lower self-management side, the more problems you may encounter in this area. Moving from assessment to action. Identify the times when your actions, reactions, or statements have created problems for you. Can you find any patterns in these situations? If you could relive them, what would you do differently? When do you feel you need to be particularly aware of your effect on others? List some specific behaviors that you might need to change. Which influence skills do you need to improve? Assessing your situation. Think about the direct and indirect influence skills discussed in this chapter. For each category that is about to be listed, use a percentage to indicate how frequently you use each set of skills in influence situations. Your percentages should add up to 100. Indirect skills. Observe and wait. Ask and listen. Direct skills. Persuade and convince. Order and act. Moving from assessment to action. Do you tend to overuse either direct or indirect skills? In which categories do you need to improve? Set some specific goals for using new influence skills. In what situations or with which people do you need to use these skills? Decide what you will do differently the next time you are in these situations. Think of someone you would like to influence. 1. What is your goal in this situation? What do you need this person to do? 2. Try to describe the world from the point of view of your influence target. What are this person's goals and problems? How would the person describe you? How would the two of you describe the issues about which you disagree? How do these viewpoints differ? 3. Consider how you or others have tried to influence this person in the past. Should you try any new strategies? What strategies have not worked well? What approaches seem to work best with this person? Chapter 10. Managing Power Relationships. In every organization, some people have more power than others. You may recall this as an organizational fact of life. You will clearly notice three basic power relationships, above, below, and equal. These simple differences create some challenging problems because many otherwise well-adjusted people have difficulty with certain power positions. Some can't stand being in the below role and automatically rebel against anyone in authority. Others work well with management, but have a tough time getting along with their peers. Those who feel uncomfortable in the above position often turn into buddy-buddy bosses who try to be best pals with their employees. Becoming a winner means successfully managing relationships in all directions. If only that were as easy as it sounds. The full circle of influence. Imagine that a group of people are going to rate your work effectiveness. This group will include your boss, your colleagues, and, if you are a manager, your employees. You will also rate yourself. Then suppose you are given a report that compares all these responses, letting you see, for example, whether your boss and your coworkers view you the same way. How do you think it would turn out? This process is known as 360-degree feedback, which many organizations use to help people get a clearer picture of the way they are perceived at work. After looking at hundreds of these reports over the years, I can quickly tell when someone has a power position issue. Certain people get high ratings from everybody except their boss. Others receive low ratings only from their peers. Some managers get high marks from everyone except their employees. In each case, the person involved has trouble with one type of power relationship, but otherwise appears to be doing a fine job. Think about yourself. If you received a 360-degree feedback report, would people in all power positions view you positively? Would your boss describe you as helpful, cooperative, and easy to work with? Would your colleagues say that you regularly listen to other points of view, share information, and provide assistance willingly? If you are a manager, would your employees describe you as supportive, respectful, and willing to listen? Would they say you set a good example as a leader? If you have any doubts about the answers, then you may want to examine your power relationships. Power difficulties often grow out of the parent, adult, and child roles that were discussed in Chapter 7. Because power relationships at work often mirror those in families, certain events or circumstances can activate an entrenched parent or child reaction that overrides our normal adult behavior. When this happens, our self-management skills vanish. We act unconsciously, and our ability to influence others is automatically diminished. Put more simply, we do some really stupid things. Upward influence is a challenge for people who automatically view anyone in management as a parent, then react like a child, becoming either rebellious and hard to manage, or submissive and overly compliant. Rebellious employees tend to be oppositional and anti-authoritarian, just like 2-year-olds and teenagers. Chris, a social worker, didn't like policies, procedures, or rules. He argued about policy decisions and looked for any possible loophole to get around restrictions. If he didn't agree with a request made by his manager, Chris simply ignored it. He took the opposite position on almost any issue about which his boss expressed an opinion. Needless to say, his manager began to feel that a conversation with Chris was about as pleasant as a root canal, so he avoided him whenever possible. Chris had virtually no upward influence in his agency. Submissive employees, on the other hand, are eager to please and afraid to disagree. Carson, a newly promoted engineering manager, was soft-spoken and agreeable. Before taking any action, he was always careful to check with his boss, and he never questioned his manager's suggestions, even if he had reservations. Although Carson's primary goal was to please his manager, the effect was quite the opposite. On a 360-degree feedback report, his manager wrote, "Carson needs to stop asking, 'What should we do?' and start saying, 'This is what we ought to do.'" Because he was reluctant to volunteer any opinion that did not feel completely safe, Carson greatly reduced his upward influence. Lateral influence. Problems arise when people take an inappropriate child role with their colleagues, often reflecting childhood patterns with siblings and playmates. The competitive youngster who always has to win, the self-sufficient child who prefers solitary activities, and the playground bully who likes to push other people around. For competitive co-workers, life is a contest, and winning is the goal. They have little interest in the needs, concerns, or problems of colleagues. Unless there is a clear and immediate personal payoff, teamwork and collaboration are viewed as useless distractions. During a department team-building session, Mark mentioned that Tanya, one of his co-workers, seldom returned phone calls or responded to requests for information. "I don't have enough hours in the day as it is," replied Tanya. "So why would I take time to do those things when they have absolutely no effect on my goals?" A few months later, when Tanya desperately needed Mark's participation in a project, he was unavailable. Surprise, surprise. Some competitors are simply not helpful, but others are annoyingly self-promoting. These folks are usually easy to spot because they consistently try to demonstrate superior knowledge and often attempt to horn in on others' projects, especially those that will increase their own visibility. Solitary colleagues prefer to work on their own. Like lone wolves, they hate hunting in packs. Because they don't find interaction particularly rewarding, their enjoyment at work comes from the tasks, not the people. In their view, teamwork and collaboration interfere with more meaningful pursuits. Daniel was one of 5 training specialists in a government agency. When selecting workshops to teach, he looked for out-of-town sessions that involved a single instructor so that he could travel by himself. Whenever possible, he used these trips to avoid staff meetings, which he felt were a complete waste of time. He spent many hours researching new material at a nearby university library, where he buried himself in the stacks with a pile of journals. Unfortunately, when budget cuts forced a staff reduction, Daniel's lack of involvement in departmental activities made him the most expendable person in the group. He was laid off. There was absolutely nothing wrong with enjoying independent activities, but too much solitude can be politically hazardous. Bullying co-workers want to get their own way. If they can push others around a little, that only makes it more fun. Simon, a product design engineer, always argued forcefully for his position in design meetings, refusing to consider other alternatives or opinions. His views often prevailed simply because he wore everyone out with his vigorous attacks. Colleagues who noticed potential design problems seldom brought them to Simon's attention, knowing that even mild criticism would be met with a verbal barrage. Over time, Simon's reputation began to decline, as most product design failures could be traced to his ideas. Had he taken a more collaborative approach, both the products and his reputation would have been better served. Downward influence is essential for leaders and managers. Because management tasks need to be performed by adults, problems inevitably occur when managers operate in either parent or child mode. Parental managers come in 2 varieties, dominating and smothering. Dominating bosses overuse their direct authority by issuing orders, directives, and reprimands. Although they may comply, employees seldom respect these little tyrants. Daryl was one such manager. Whenever an employee displeased him, he would yell, "I might just have to fire you." Finally, the entire staff confronted him as a group, pointing out that these threats weren't very helpful to morale. To which Daryl replied, "I may just fire all of you for this." Although Daryl was obviously clueless, he wasn't really a bad guy, simply an insecure new manager who didn't understand how to use authority effectively. He eventually developed more self-confidence and became a better leader. Smothering managers who get intensely involved in the details of their employees' work usually see themselves as concerned, conscientious, and helpful. But employees are more likely to view this hovering attentiveness as interference and micromanagement. Roberta, the manager of a district sales office, had smothering tendencies. She carefully reviewed her salespeople's reports, proposals, and travel schedules, asked them to copy her on all correspondence, and often accompanied them on sales calls. Not surprisingly, salespeople usually transferred out of Roberta's district as soon as a position became available elsewhere. Managers who operate from the child position are uncomfortable having authority over others. Because they worry about being liked, they try to be everyone's pal. Although most employees don't want a domineering boss, they don't want a spineless jellyfish either. So buddy-buddy bosses get little respect. Nell, a supervisor, who received a 360-degree feedback report, was dismayed by low ratings from her staff. "I thought they liked me," she lamented, "but apparently they don't like me at all." Actually, liking had nothing to do with it. Nell's survey results clearly showed that her employees wanted stronger direction, more feedback, and the resolution of some performance problems. In other words, they wanted Nell to act like a manager. Ironically, these were the very actions that she had avoided, fearing that they would make her less likable. Nell was learning a fundamental lesson of downward influence, that being respected is much more important than being liked. If you see yourself in any of those descriptions, or if you just want to further hone your influence skills, then consider the strategies outlined in just a moment. As you've probably figured out, consistently operating as an adult is a basic requirement for managing power relationships. Upward influence, managing your boss. Let's be honest. If you got to pick your boss, you might make a different choice. But in the real world, you have to work for anyone who happens to be favored by management. Even a boss who is totally incompetent still has enough position power to make your life fairly miserable. So the more effectively you can influence upward, the more pleasant your days are likely to be. Toward that end, here are some suggestions for managing bosses in a politically intelligent manner. 1. Accept the fact that your boss has been given the power to direct your activities. This is true even if you are much smarter than he is, even if you should have been given his job, even if he is the most obnoxious loudmouth on the planet. You are stuck with this boss for the immediate future, so becoming rebellious will only make a bad situation worse. Accepting reality and working to increase your influence will produce better results. 2. Don't expect perfection. Managers are people, not androids, so they have an endless variety of quirks and eccentricities and odd little habits. Recognize your boss's hot buttons, and for heaven's sake, don't push them. There's a name for people who annoy their managers on purpose, masochists. If you have a wonderful boss who is a pleasure to work with, celebrate. Be grateful every day for as long as it lasts. If not, lower your expectations. 3. Study your boss's management style and figure out what makes her happy. Look for clues that tell you how she likes work done, or how she prefers to get information. If you're not sure what your boss expects from you, in terms of results, work habits, communication style, or anything else, then don't try to guess. Ask. You need to find out ASAP. Any reasonable manager will gladly answer these questions and, in fact, will be pleased and surprised by your interest. 4. Try to make your boss look good. Produce quality results. Meet deadlines. Stay within your budget. Respond to people quickly. Find problems that need solving and address them. Contribute new ideas and suggestions. Share useful information with your boss. Your own political power will grow when your manager tells everybody how wonderful you are. 5. Never, never, never complain to others about your boss, especially to people outside your department or to your employees if you are a manager. Strategizing with trusted peers about how to handle your manager's more challenging peculiarities is one thing, kind of like a group therapy session. But trumpeting your unhappiness far and wide will only get you in trouble. 6. Give your boss a sincere compliment from time to time. Managers hear lots of complaints, but few employees ever bother to give their boss a kind word. Unless your manager resembles Attila the Hun or Adolf Hitler, you can surely find some quality worth praising. Mention it at some appropriate point. But let's be clear. Paying a sincere compliment is not the same as groveling or sucking up. 7. Finally, don't forget the old saying, it's not your boss who protects your job, it's your boss's boss. Look for opportunities to interact with higher-level managers. If they know who you are and think well of you, then you will have enhanced both your political power and your job security. Conflicts between employees and managers can be especially dangerous after a management change. Some people get used to one type of boss, have trouble adjusting to a different style, and angrily head down the road to political suicide. When the powers that be give you a new manager, recognize that the world has changed, so you'd better change with it. Unless you have enormous leverage, you will not be overthrowing your boss. Any hostility or resistance will only get you tagged as hard to manage. One executive who inherited a rather antagonistic staff summed this up quite neatly. Either people change or we change people. If you had the ideal boss before, that was good luck for you. But that's the past. Now you must figure out how to work with a different person, even if you're not happy about it. If you can keep an open mind, you may actually find that they have some new things to teach you. Some of my most valuable lessons were learned working for a nightmare CEO. I wouldn't particularly want to repeat the experience, but it was undeniably educational. The view from the top. How to work with executives. Managing your boss is one thing. Working with executives can be quite another. Because they have a tremendous amount of power, high-level executives are accustomed to doing and saying whatever they want, making them a unique breed that must be handled with care. Although many managers like to call themselves executives, only a few really have extensive power. So let's be specific about the people who belong in this category. In the business world, we're talking about the CEO or president of a company. And if it's a really large organization, possibly their direct reports as well. In the public sector, elected officials and high-level political appointees are really the only ones who qualify. If you are a lowly peon who is fortunate enough, or unfortunate enough, depending on your point of view, to interact with these exalted beings, the following guidelines may help you keep your sanity, and possibly your job. 1. Don't ever tell executives that they can't do anything. Nothing riles an executive more than being told they can't do something. Because you know what? They can if they want to. So saying you can't will only start an argument that you will inevitably lose. When you're trying to keep your particular executive from doing something really stupid, try beginning your sentence with, "Yes, we can do that, but let me ask you something," followed by whatever question or concern you may have. Amazingly enough, that simple acknowledgement of their power usually keeps them calm. 2. Talk fast. Executives are busy people with tight schedules. They are also very bright people who can absorb information quickly without a lot of explanation. And even if more explanation would be helpful, you're not going to have a chance to give it. Start with your most important points and move quickly. But be prepared for them to pepper you with questions after about 3 sentences. Executives don't want to listen to a monologue. They want to control the conversation, get the information they need, and move on to their next appointment. 3. Don't expect specific instructions. Executive brains are usually shifting quickly from one big important issue to the next, so their instructions are typically about half clear.